From Columbus, this is the OSU Review, a radio magazine about people and events at Ohio State. I'm Tom Weeble.
And I'm Mike Lombardi. In this edition, voices and fingerprints. Are they equal in positive identification? Several OSU researchers tell us no. Two of them are twin sisters whose experience contributed to the study. Also, agricultural technology from Ohio State contributes to a Natural Resources Department project which determines the best use of undeveloped land.
An on-the-scene report about movement therapy and how it benefits mental patients, plus a final comment on the nation's longest coal strike.
All in this edition of the OSU Review.
Well, the voice print shows the frequencies composed in the utterance of a particular speech sound, displayed with the low frequencies at the bottom of the page and the higher frequencies towards the top as a function of time. In other words, how these frequencies vary along a time axis as the speech sound is modified and as you make the transition from one speech sound to the next speech sound.
John Perkins, lecturer in linguistics, the science of language. Perkins' specialty is the study of phonetics or speech sounds. It is possible to transfer voice sound waves to a graphic display that looks like a series of smudges or streaks of different intensity. This is called voice printing or sound spectrogram. Such voice prints have been used in the courtroom as evidence against persons suspected of making telephone threats. By comparing the original call with a later recording of the suspect, convictions have resulted. But Perkins doesn't think the process is that reliable now at this stage of development. And the human voice, he says, can fool the machine.
The voice print, as it's called, I'd rather call it a sound spectrogram, shows just the objective frequencies involved in the utterance of a speech sound. And that's all it shows. We have to interpret from that information. So anything that can be done to modify the way that our mouth or throat or nose cavities resonate during the production of a word will change what the voice print looks like. So, for instance, it's possible to change the voice print of your pronunciation of a particular word simply by putting a dental plate in your mouth or stuffing a piece of cotton in your mouth or holding your nose.
Mm-hmm. And that would upset the spectrogram.
Right. That'd be sufficient to make the properties that are the patterns that are matched in voice print identification look different.
Has this been used in the courtroom?
Yes, it's been admitted as evidence in over 50 court cases throughout the country.
Has it been challenged?
Yeah, certainly it's been challenged a number of times. I don't know exactly the exact number. Mm-hmm. But people who are acoustic phoneticians by training, such as myself, tend to appear in court proceedings only to challenge the use of so-called voice prints for identification purposes.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think under certain circumstances, certain conditions, that they could hold up, and indeed you could, live with it if certain changes were made in how it all works?
I could live with it if it were established what aspects of the sound waves that we create when we make speech sounds are characteristic of the individual anatomy, but that is not known at the present.
So that's where research lies.
Yes, right. I think voice identification is theoretically possible, but it's beyond our scope at the moment. We don't know what are the acoustic characteristics that we use to identify different voices at the present time.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know how they're represented on this pictorial display.
John Perkins of the OSU Department of Linguistics. Also doing graduate work in that same area is Debbie Schaefer, who agrees with Perkins.
In order to improve voice printing techniques, I think we need to find some firm objective techniques for evaluating different voices and evaluating how similar or different voice prints are. And twin voices, if they are more similar than other voices, would make good control groups for this kind of evaluation comparison. So the first step would be to evaluate the voices of twins themselves. Are they more similar? How much do they differ from other voices in their similarity? If we can find some way of stating that objectively, then we can use twin voices in testing voice printing analyses.
Debbie Schaefer and her twin sister Rachel are following parallel careers at Ohio State, both interested in language and speech techniques. So it's logical that Debbie would turn to the study of other twins as a part of her investigation of voices and their differences.
The basic idea was just to devise an experiment to see if the voices of twins are harder to tell apart than the voices of non-twins. And I broke that down into testing the voices of siblings of the same sex and voices of unrelated pairs of the same sex. So it's actually a three-way test.
Now, obviously, since your twin Rachel is also sitting here, your own experience, I would imagine, led to this type of study.
Well, definitely. It's just because I had one pair of subjects already available.
Rachel, from in the background of the two of you, has voice confusion been a problem over the years for you?
Not that I can remember. Usually on the phone, our friends can tell us apart because they know us well enough already. And in class, well, we're usually both there, and they just look at us instead of listen to us.
Okay, now back to Debbie. And now we've had a chance to get some voice contrast here, too. How have you proceeded? What's your approach been here?
Well, I found 8 pairs of subjects. 4 were twins, 2 were siblings, and 2 were unrelated pairs, and I divided them equally for sex. And then I devised 8 listening tests using these 8 pairs. I had pairs of utterances within each test, and each pair was either produced by the same voice or by 2 different voices. Then the listeners heard the tape and had to make judgments about each pair of utterances, whether the voices they heard were of different speakers or the same speaker.
Debbie, we're going to roll a sample tape now that you brought with you. And let's just play a little of that and listen, and then you can explain what we've heard as a part of your testing out your theories here.
And to the Republic for which it stands, with liberty and justice for all. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. This above all, to thine own self be true.
Okay, now tell us what we've been hearing.
Okay, those were 3 of the pairs on one test using voices of twins. The listeners would hear these 3 pairs and then try and decide if the voices were the same or different for each of the pairs.
How sharp are listeners in picking out which is which?
Well, most of them got most of the correct identifications. So it was more a matter of which test had the most mistakes, not how many mistakes they made. And for 3 of the 4 pairs of twins, more mistakes were made on their test than on the other.
Rachel, voices can, in general ways, sound very much alike, but there are a lot of characteristics which make them different, right?
Oh, yes.
Tell me a little about that.
Well, probably the major difference would be in pitch. All right, a man's voice is much deeper than a woman's. Women's voice differ in pitch, and so do men's. Speech habits, like pausing a lot, different hesitation noises like tone qualities, very nasal or just normal. There's many more. I just can't think of them right now.
Let's kind of use you two for analysis now. You said, in general, people are able to tell the two of you apart.
If they know us well enough.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you analyze yourselves for us here? This is Rachel over here, for example. In what ways do you think you may differ from Debbie?
Okay. Friends have told us that my voice sounds deeper, for one thing.
What about the way you pronounce words? Any difference at all there?
There shouldn't be. I can only think of one example that isn't really completely natural anyway.
Mm-hmm. The fact that you have grown up together and or whether you were twins or not, just being in the same family, do people then naturally share the same techniques and ways they pronounce words?
Well, environment has a lot to do with how similar voices are, and it studies have shown that members of families do tend to have certain characteristics of their speech alike, but there's a lot of outside influences, where you go to school and where you've traveled, that can cause changes, little changes.
Identical twins, Debbie and Rachel Schaefer, who are testing the characteristics of voices that set us apart as individuals.
In late March, a group of local government officials took part in an OSU short course on land use planning. They came to find out more about such things as resource development, private property rights, and zoning problems. Tom Weibel talked briefly with two participants, the mayor of Tiffin, Thomas Yeager, and member of the Shelby Planning Commission, Ray Pugh. First, Mayor Yeager discussing the fact that citizens don't always understand how complex a city operation is.
That's always the case, really. We talk about, for example, sewers, something no one is interested in as long as theirs is working at their home. But yet that's where the largest amount of our funds are going to have to be going in the near future.
What kind of special problems have you seen in the last year or so in your area?
We've had a somewhat unique problem in our area that we experienced five major fires that have burned out there, portions of the city, some right in the central business district. This there again comes back to land use. We now have wide open spaces right in the middle of the business district that need to be redeveloped.
Well, I think many of the problems are involved around the city utilities. And we are fortunate to have our own city light plant, and a very well-planned plant, by the way. But our sewers, sewer distribution, water's not much of a problem, but I think in any community, sewers are the big problem. And we are in the process of getting in some new industry, some mobile home park.
What can you offer to industry in a town? You said around 10,000 or even less is your size?
Yeah. Well, I think most ever any organization, whether it's industry or business of any kind, comes into a community, they're looking for a good place to raise a family.
Ray Pugh of Shelby in Richland County, preceded by Tiffin Mayor Thomas Yeager. Also on hand at the OSU Land Use Conference was Cal Taylor. Taylor is Resource Administrator in the Division of Water under the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. Taylor explains a project called OCAP, which has enabled one county, Wyandotte, to utilize a computerized land analysis in determining a fair tax rate for farmland.
The Ohio Capability Analysis Program is a computerized information storage system that can readily store information all the way from soil information to groundwater resources to flood information, and can then manipulate the information and produce it in a map form, which combined with an overlay of an ordinary quadrangle or topographic map can identify areas that are suitable for certain types of developments within a county or a watershed or some mapping unit we should decide upon. And it's an efficient way to handle a lot of data, and it can do much more than a human mind can do or with simple drafting. And that's why we have gone to this route. And one of the projects that we have, for example, to show the diversity of the OCAP program and what it can do, is the Wyandotte County Tax Assessment Project with the cooperation of the College of Agriculture at Ohio State University and the Ohio Agriculture Research and Development Center, which is a research arm of that college. Working with the people at the university and with the county auditor and county commissioners in Wyandotte County, we have undertaken a project there by which we can enter parcel boundary information from property ownership maps in the local area, as well as soil information as it's completed by the Division of Lands and Soils in the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. Combine those two sets of information in a rather quick form and map them out. Once we've done that, the people at Ohio State University, working in cooperation with the county auditor, have assigned a productivity index to each type of soil. So then they can assess local property taxes on the basis of productivity of soil rather than on other criteria that they have done in the past. This is the first such project of this kind in the state, and we're anxious to see how it turns out. And right now it looks very enthusiastic.
In other words, you foresee good reception by farmers to this approach?
I think so, because it's a very equitable way of doing it on a sound, rational basis rather than on the basis of speculation or other criteria that's been used in the past. This is allowed now under Ohio law. A few years ago, Amendment 1 was passed, I believe, to the Ohio Constitution, allowed assessment of agriculture land on the basis of productivity and not merely on the basis of speculation, which has driven a lot of farmers out of business around urban fringes.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, when you're evaluating productivity, then you're saying it's a combination of things, not just the soil.
Well, in the case of Wyandotte County, it's primarily the soil that we're looking at, depending on whether it should be a Brookston Crosby loam soil or a Hoytville soil or some other kind that might be found in that county. As to what productivity you might get out of it. A very high clay content soil, you might get very low productivity. Depends on other factors of the soil necessarily.
Now, if that soil happens to be located along in a floodplain, for example, it might be inundated part of the year. Could that be included in the feed out of information and right as it stands now?
Yes, it could be. As a matter of fact, a little takeoff from that. In other areas where we're using OCAP studies right now, all the other projects are dealing with the OCAP studies in some way other than taxation assessment. We have done studies in the area of 208 water quality planning in the Dayton area, five-county Dayton area. Also, we're doing it now in the Akron area and in the Cleveland area. We're also working with the Coastal Zone Management Program in Ohio along the shoreline counties and 1,000-meter area along the shore of Lake Erie. We soon will be working with the Youngstown area, Tri-County area up there, in doing another 208 study where we can actually put various information into the OCAP program, such as groundwater resources, soil, which is necessarily our basic input, flood-prone areas, census tracts, traffic zones. We've even gone so far as put school districts in. Depending on what the local county or local contracting entity, and in our case it is a county, we work primarily with counties, desires and what their purpose is in using it. Mm-hmm. We will assist them in identifying what their problems are through our continuing assistance section of our unit of our section, and then also following up once the basic set of capability maps are presented to the county. Usually this ranges around 50 maps of any one area we present to them on various types of development potential. We will then work with them to update as any new applications of OCAP come along and help them as they see new applications of the information they've already obtained.
Cal Taylor of the Natural Resources Department.
You're listening to the OSU Review, where next we hear about movement therapy.
So your body is just one part from your hips to your shoulders, just moving over one knee and then the other. And try and keep your hips centered so it's kind of a low feeling. There's no rise to it yet. Good. See if you can't take one foot off the floor. So the weight comes off, but there's still that down feeling to it. Good. Let's hang on and see if we can't establish a group rhythm. Right.
Ellen Mall is a dancer, and a pretty good dancer.
Kind of
but the class she's instructing is not wearing ballet shoes or leotards. In fact, they have their shoes kicked off for added comfort. They're standing in a circle getting direction from Ellen and how to loosen their shoulders to rid themselves of stale tension and develop better body flow. The group consists of staff members of Upham Hall, the psychiatric unit of university hospitals. They're learning the techniques of movement therapy or dance therapy, so they in turn can work with patients to support Ellen's work. The idea is to encourage patients to express good feelings about themselves and improve their body image. Ellen Mall, dancer turned therapist, says it can be very effective.
It involves a little bit of a lift and a push.
We call ourselves dance therapists because of our dance background. That's where we've come from. And I think that's an important element in the work that we do. The ability to be able to analyze movement is not there for someone who is not experienced taking movement combinations into their body and then using space with that interest. The most regressed patient in the hospital can probably derive the most benefit as far as seeing other people having fun and getting a chance to participate as much as they can on a nonverbal level, because this is a client that's not going to be on a verbal level talking with the other therapist.
Come on, Bob, let's go.
Now send everything out into far reach space. Just let it go.
The session is based on my dance background and the kind of things that I know about movement. And I try and utilize some, you know, slow stretching, shaking warm-ups, and then get into, oh, just moving around just for the heck of it, to kind of feel good about your body and also to start learning about your nonverbal communication and how you can relate to others. The activity is non-competitive, you know, it's not a win-lose kind of a thing. Everybody can participate as much as they choose to, and it's just kind of a fun-producing thing, and also can give material for therapy if that is the goal, to continue getting some verbal insight from the information.
Oh, it's the art form that counts, let me tell you.
I like to define the function and dysfunction of the client, and from there just decide how they're progressing, and when we both decide they're functional, therapy ends. I think everyone can benefit from moving. I think that especially when you're down, it's important to just pick yourself up and do something, and even if it's just, you know, a brisk walk around the house, it can really help. I mean, everybody has their own physical limitation, and everybody knows their own body and what they can do and what they can't do. But I just try and have people see that as a positive thing. You know, if you have arthritis and you can only move a little, we should move that little.
No, this is not called shape up or ship out. It's called shape and attend.
I feel that I'm a people-centered person, and in the performance role, you're on stage and you get the feedback from the audience, but you don't really get to look into people's eyes, and that's the fun part for me. I think there's several adolescent females that I've worked with that have had the chief complaint of anorexia nervosa, which is just not eating and having a real problem with eating and a problem with body image. And working with some of these gals to just develop a movement repertoire that feels like them. You know, I would characterize it more of a feminine movement repertoire. They're not afraid to be a girl. And that's kind of a really kind of a fun thing to watch someone come out of their shell that way.
Now just try swimming.
Ellen Mall, Ohio State's dancer and instructor in movement therapy, who has given up the spotlights and applause, trading it for an occasional smile and the satisfaction of watching one person get well.
Now just try opening out. Opening out to each other, opening out to the space. Any way you want to really come open. Right. Can we try gathering in? Can we gather in everybody? Right. Gather in everybody.
Let's pretend we're finished. And I'll go.
Good.
Now that we're all here.
Okay, let's come together and do the same thing that we started with, that easy sway, just to finish.
Norris, quit. So great to be here.
There was applause, shouting, and laughter when the long coal strike finally ended, the longest one ever. And here is commentary on the strike and its effects offered by Dr. Herbert Parnes, chairman of Ohio State's Faculty of Labor and Human Resources and a professor of economics.
I think the recent coal strike provides almost perfect examples of four important aspects of the American industrial relations system. First, it demonstrates that collective bargaining is basically a process of compromise among conflicting interests in which there are rarely any objective standards for determining what is right. The coal operators' concern for efficiency led them to insist on contract provisions that would penalize wildcat strikers. The miners refused to accept such provisions because they saw wildcat strikes as the only effective means of guaranteeing safe working conditions. Clearly, there are no absolute rights and wrongs in matters of these kinds. Second, the recent experience demonstrates the essential role of a strike to produce compromise by bringing hardship to bear on both sides. Both the mine workers and the coal operators feared that they would be required to substitute industry-wide bargaining for local bargaining if the impasse continued. Moreover, even the frugal miners were beginning to feel a real economic pinch. Hence, both sides were willing to agree to something less than they had earlier regarded as the minimum acceptable terms. Third, it demonstrates that it is ordinarily logically impossible to blame a strike on only one side or the other, since a stoppage cannot occur unless both parties are willing that it should. Either side can prevent the strike or can stop it at any point by giving in to the other. To be sure, the union generally calls the strike, but it is clear that the employer can create conditions that make a work stoppage inevitable. The coal strike is a particularly dramatic example of this point, for the operators were insisting on terms that would have taken away from the miners rights they had enjoyed under the previous contract. Finally, the coal strike dispels the mistaken notion that strikes occur because dictatorial union leaders lead unwilling rank-and-file members into work stoppages. It was the rank-and-file members of the United Mine Workers, of course, who initially rejected the contract negotiated by their leaders. Collective bargaining has the merit of regulating the amazingly diverse and complex terms and conditions of employment in the economy, and does this in a remarkably democratic manner, that is, with the participation and ultimate consent of the parties most intimately concerned.
Dr. Herbert Parnes, chairman of Ohio State's Faculty of Labor and Human Resources. And that concludes this edition of the OSU Review. The program is produced by Tom Weeble for the Office of Public Affairs. Technical assistance provided by Ed Thompson. With Tom Weeble, this is Mike Lombardi.